Your Honors, may it please the Court. It's nice to be here. I don't get down here as much as I did when I was younger, but it's always a pleasure to be here. Your Honors, this is, as you well know, and may it please the Court, this is an appeal from the lower court, initially Master's recommendation, which was adopted by Judge Slights, except in one respect unfavorably to our position. From a motion for post-conviction relief, which was filed on Mr. Burns' behalf. As the Court is aware, the Court has already handled this case on direct appeal, affirming the conviction after having remanded it in part. So the idea for this motion for post-conviction relief actually germinated prior to the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions in Lafler and the companion case, and although I can see that the Court has dealt in some regards with these issues now, I would respectfully suggest that this is the first case which calls for the application of that U.S. Supreme Court decision to Delaware jurisprudence. In this case, the defendant was represented by Mr. Overly at trial. Ms. Manning was the prosecutor, and she is present. And basically, as is indicated in our statement of facts, prior to the commencement of the trial, there was a plea offer that had been extended to Mr. Burns. He was charged, as you can see and as you well know, with multiple counts of rape in the second degree. Under the law, convictions for rape in the second degree carried with them a mandatory minimum jail sentence of 10 years, so that Mr. Burns was facing, upon conviction, a minimum mandatory jail sentence of 54 years. As it was, as you know, after trial, he was acquitted of some counts, convicted of some counts, and ultimately a sentence was imposed of 41 years suspended after serving 35 years, 32 of which, I believe, or minimum mandatory years. Prior to trial, there was a plea offer extended by Ms. Manning whereby the defendant could have pled guilty to reduced charges of unlawful sexual contact, which carried a prison term of up to 3 years, but no minimum mandatory jail time. And in addition to the reduction or the diminution of the charges that were offered, the state actually was going to recommend to Judge Brady, who was the trial judge, a probationary term. As fatefully occurred, Mr. Burns rejected that plea, and we got involved at this point in time, subsequently, and have filed this appeal on his behalf, arguing primarily that his lawyer at the time was ineffective in the manner in which the plea negotiations were conducted, thereby...
Well, is it the way the negotiations were conducted or in the advice that was given to the client?
Correct, yes. Yes, if I can be clear, you're right, okay. Justice Jacobs.
And just to clarify it further, is your argument that that the defendant was not furnished or told sufficient facts by his counsel, or
no?
Is it that those facts were not wrapped up with an affirmative recommendation of some kind?
It would be the latter. Okay. If I could expand on that just a little bit.
So basically, Mr. Overly was ineffective because he didn't come down with the bottom line recommendation that the plea be accepted?
I would say yes, for two reasons. All the cases talk about the difficulty of reviewing these matters in hindsight. In hindsight, we are not making any argument that Mr. Overly did not investigate the case properly, not that it matters anymore under the Supreme Court decision, try the case properly. That he didn't advise, except for some minor points that we put in the brief, which I don't think are, which I don't really suggest are determinative. But for the most part, he advised the client of the evidence against him. He, knowing Mr. Overly the way that I do, I'm sure he investigated the case exhaustively.
Okay.
And we are not arguing anything there.
I think we understand.
Okay.
It's a very narrow argument.
Correct.
All right. And doesn't your position presuppose that the client who, you know, we're told was given all of the material facts, that is, considerations, you know, what happens if you go to trial and don't take the plea, what happens if you get the plea, was incapable of assessing that information by himself, correct?
It does, okay. Yes.
So if that's the case, then are you asking this court to adopt a rule that would, in effect, render all counsel representation in the context of a plea offer ineffective unless that counsel comes down with a bottom-line recommendation?
No, Your Honor.
Then how can you distinguish this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think if you look at the two Second Circuit cases that we relied upon heavily in our brief, the first one was Berea versus Keene, and that case seemed to hold or seemed to suggest that under all circumstances, the criminal defense attorney has an obligation to opine to his client that they should or should not take a plea. The Purdy case, which came subsequent to the Berea case, without overruling Berea, narrowed the inquiry. And it would be our position that, at least for purposes of deciding this case, that may be an issue that comes up later in a different case or under different circumstances, but our argument in this case is very fact-specific, that under these specific facts of this specific case, with the knowledge and experience that the trial attorney had in this matter, that there was an affirmative obligation, as was found to be the case in Purdy.
Well, that would be a you know, certainly a way to avoid the hard work of having to advise the public and you know, the parties to future criminal litigation you know, about what the obligation of defense counsel is. Unfortunately, you know, it doesn't always turn out to be that easy. So are you telling us that you're unable to craft a limiting principle?
I'm sorry, that you're able to or unable to?
Unable to. Because, you know, if we were to agree with your position in this case and limit it to these circumstances, all that does is invite the next case where it will be argued that as a matter of law, representation is ineffective.
Well,
there's a bottom line recommendation.
I think eventually you may have to deal with the broader issue if a lawyer wants to make that particular argument, but I don't think that we have to make that argument in this case because under the Berea decision, as the Purdy case said, this isn't going to be very jurisprudential, but that was a no-brainer. I mean, in that particular case, the guy was offered 1 to 3 years. He was went to trial and got convicted and got 20 years in jail. And his lawyer did not advise him that he should accept that plea. So that was an easy case. And we are taking the position that in this particular case, that this is an easy case too. Because you have a situation where, which I've already outlined, where you're talking about so many years in jail on the one hand, and such a good plea offer on the other hand, that a lawyer who is a competent defense...
The plea offer was to felonies, correct?
Correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Do we have a factual finding by the trial court that your client was unwilling to accept any plea to any felony?
I believe that we have a factual finding based upon Mr. Oberle's affidavit.
Well, then how can you establish prejudice when we have that factual backdrop, that no matter what Mr. Oberle should have done, could have done, or would have done, that the client would not have accepted the plea offer?
Well, I don't think we had, with all due respect, I don't think we have a factual finding that the client, that's the problem with this record, would not have accepted a plea to a felony, just that based upon the information that had been provided to him, that he said that he was not going to accept a felony plea. What we don't have in this record is, and in response to Justice Jacobs, I mean, as a defense lawyer, there are some cases where you can't call it. I mean, you can say to a client, I have this case where you should plead, this one where rarely, where maybe you shouldn't. Some of them fall right in the middle where you can't make that call. But in this case, it's our position that knowing how juries are in Newcastle County, the seriousness of the charges, instead of suggesting to the client that you could win the case, with all due respect, and it's nice to have confidence, instead of doing that, that the appraisal should have been more sobering, and that an affirmative duty arose under these circumstances to advise the client that he should accept the plea. Now,
well,
Justice,
aren't we going to have to live in a world of 20/20 hindsight from now on? Because when a plea is offered and your attorney says you might be able to win this one, the charges involve sex abuse, sexual misconduct, and therefore would carry with it enormous stigma going forward. And this attorney said, here are your choices, and didn't say you should take the plea offer, because this attorney apparently had some confidence that he could get his client off. Now, it didn't work out that way. So now we'll go back and say that this attorney was ineffective because his evaluation of the case turned out to be wrong?
Well, with all due respect, I believe under the circumstances in this case we can. Clients listen, some clients, good clients listen to us. When I say to a client, I think we can win this case, and believe me, not that what I do matters one way or another. If I say I think I can win this case, and this client likes me and respects me and thinks I'm really good, they're going to listen to me when I say that. That's going to have a lot of sway over what they do. And in this case, Mr. Oberle had a very good reputation. I'm sure Mr. Burns went to him for his experience. And when Mr. Oberle says to him, this is a case that could be won, with all due respect to Mr. Oberle, it's a little bit irresponsible in terms of what you're dealing with. I mean, this guy's sitting in jail for 35 years now. And from what you're saying, I understand that we're going to be examining this. It happens all the time in these cases anyway that we're looking at. I mean, the Superior Court is developing procedures now to determine, to make the process a little bit more apparent because of the Supreme Court's decision and what's
now
been happening.
I'd like to ask my earlier question.
Okay.
Different.
I'm sorry, I got.
Is it your client's burden to demonstrate that if Mr. Oberle had given the advice that you claim he should have given, that he would have accepted the plea and the plea offer? And has that burden been satisfied?
Well, I obviously have to answer that it's not our burden to do that because we have not satisfied it. We did not have an evidentiary hearing in this case on this issue. The only word we have on this is what Mr. Oberle put in his affidavit in terms of the record, in terms of what happened. And the position that I would take is that in this case, I mean, this is just not a case where a guy gets offered a plea and then says, I'm never going to take a plea under any circumstances. In this case, our argument is that he didn't have all of the marbles on the floor in front of him to make that decision.
But you told us he did.
Well,
all he was lacking was a bottom line recommendation.
He's lacking our recommendation. That's what we do as lawyers. I mean, in your private practice and all of your private practices, you give advice to people. A giant corporation doesn't come to you with this problem and then you stand back and say, okay, these are the facts. I think maybe we can win. You decide. We as defense lawyers are hired or paid to represent people as public defenders to advise people.
All right. Not well, let's test that.
Okay.
You know, your claim is that you know, at least in these circumstances, Mr. Oberle was ineffective because he didn't make a bottom line recommendation.
Correct.
Suppose Mr. Oberle, in good faith, said to Mr. Burns, "Look, I think we can win this case, and here's why. I have a recommendation. I recommend that you go to trial." And the result is the same as actually occurred. What would be your client's position then?
I think I would have the same position because I don't think you're going to find a reasonable defense attorney.
It isn't just that he didn't come down with the bottom line, it's that he didn't come, that is, Mr. Oberle didn't come down with the bottom line that your client, in hindsight, would like him to have come down with.
Well, that's one way of putting it, but I mean,
but
in foresight,
that's your position.
That is our position.
Okay.
And I'm sorry.
That, you know, given that position, I also repeat the question that Justice Ridgely did. Mr. Oberle said, that he was told by your client, I'm not going to accept any plea that, has these, that imposes these particular burdens on me. Your client didn't respond to that. So that's the record we have, and you're now arguing that we can't take cognizance of what's in Mr.
No, I'm saying that with respect, you can, but it's common understanding. People change their mind all the time. Clients say, "Oh, I'm never going to plead guilty." The job that we have, respectfully, and hopefully this court will agree, as defense attorneys, is to help people make that decision, not to just ignore it.
You're into your rebuttal time if you want to save the rest of it.
That's my fault. I guess I misunderstood what was here. Thank you.
May it please the court, Josette Manning on behalf of the state. Your Honors, if I may start with addressing some of the points raised by Mr. Maurer. First and foremost, the burden under Lafler and Frye falls directly on the defendant to prove that he would have accepted the plea at the time it was offered. And that burden has absolutely not been met in this matter.
Now, is that because there were contested contentions of fact and that they were resolved by the court, or is that because Mr. Oberle said that and there was nothing in opposition, or what? Should there be an evidentiary hearing on that?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Oberle did say that was the fact, the case, but his record was supplemented with actual letters to the defendant as well as to the prosecutor indicating the status of the events at that time. And in those records, those exhibits that he attached to his affidavit, it is clear that the defendant in this matter maintained his innocence throughout the plea negotiation process and was emphatic that he would not accept a plea to any sex offense, not even just a felony sex offense, but no sex offense. Well, and that was the only offer ever made.
Well, sometimes people who maintain their innocence plead no contest if the plea offer is good enough. So is that in the letters as well?
There's no discussion about no contest. That was never an offer that was contemplated. However, in Mr.
So, just so I understand, your plea offer was to plead guilty?
Correct. And
well, just to clarify one factual matter, is it correct that after Mr. Oberle submitted his affidavit with all the attached correspondence, nothing was forthcoming from the other side to contradict it?
There was nothing, Your Honor.
And is it fair to conclude that there was an opportunity for the defendant to file an affidavit of his own if he wished to, counter whatever Mr. Oberle was representing to the court?
Yes, Your Honor, he was represented by counsel during that time, and there was an opportunity both to reply and to contest the commissioner's findings. The defense relies on the Boria and Purdy cases from the Second District. However, Purdy clearly, in its opinion, takes what appeared to be the strength of Boria and addresses it and says, we did not intend that to be a blunt legal instrument. We did not intend to require that lawyers give explicit opinions to their clients. They're not prohibiting it, but they're not requiring it. And Purdy specifically stated that was not required.
Well, is the law, the current state of the law, that as long as a defense attorney furnishes to his client, his or her client, all the facts that are material to the pros and cons of accepting a plea offer, then counsel has discharged his or her responsibility.
Yes, Your Honor. And that, in fact, happened in this case many times. Mr. Oberle, based on his affidavit and the exhibits that he submitted with it, met many times with the defendant, with his support person who was helping him with this decision. They discussed all of the ramifications of the plea, all of the terms. And, in fact, Mr. Oberle told him, this is a generous offer. You should consider it. After he rejected it, he said, take time. Call me back. Let me know what you want to do. And he did. There has to be a line between giving your client advice and trampling on their right, their decision, their fundamental right to plead guilty or not guilty. And Mr. Oberle did just that. He did not offend either by giving the advice that he gave. As far as talking about winning the case, Mr. Maurer suggested that the statement it could be won was irresponsible. But if you cannot opine to a client with your 35 years of trial experience and after an intense investigation of the case whether or not you think a case is winnable, that would be more problematic. That is what the client is seeking. And he made an assessment, and he said he thought the case could be won, but it was qualified. He also went on to say that although the case can be won, I cannot guarantee that you will win. You may be acquitted. This is a child sex case. Juries don't like them. He laid that all out.
He did lay it out, and it's in the record?
It is in the record, and it's in his affidavit. Not exactly in those words, I believe. If you would like, I can give you those words. Cases like this one are extremely difficult. There's no physical evidence to substantiate the charges. They are, however, two alleged victims who will corroborate each other. This will, however, you should note that the state will use as evidence the note to show the innocent nature of the children and that Tina was afraid to tell her mother, etc. He's laying out the strength of the state's case, but he's also saying this is a generous offer that you should consider. In his reply brief, Mr. Maurer...
But before you get there, that last comment raises another question that I think needs to get clarified, and that is, you know, there are three possibilities in terms of Mr. Oberle having given or not having given a bottom line recommendation. The first is he made no recommendation. The second, which is suggested by that one sentence that you read, is that he did make a recommendation, but he did it softly. And the third is those are the two. And the argument is, I guess, if the second is correct, that he should have done it more loudly.
That's essentially the defense argument, Your Honor, yes, that he was not aggressive enough, that he did not push hard enough, that he didn't twist Mr. Burns' arm into taking a plea that appeared so reasonable in light of the minimum mandatories that he was facing. And that's exactly what counsel says in his reply brief, that when there's a lengthy period of mandatory incarceration and probation is offered, counsel is obligated to recommend acceptance of the plea. I don't think that's a proposition that can be supported by the law and certainly is not in a client's best interest. This was, by all accounts, by the Superior Court's analysis and by all the parties' analysis, a complicated, close case. To say that it was winnable is not a comment that is problematic, but it's also not hardline advice. He did not say, take this plea. Do not take this plea. And that is the position that the defense is arguing for.
Let me ask my question in a maybe more helpful way. The argument that's being made to us is that there was a duty on the part of defense counsel, in this case at least, to give a bottom line recommendation. If the fact is that there was a bottom line recommendation, that changes the nature of the issue that we have to decide. And so it is important for us to know what is the state's position factually as to what occurred.
There was not a bottom line position as to whether or not to take the plea offer.
All right.
He was instructed that it was a generous one and that he should consider it, and he was advised thoroughly on the pros and cons of taking it and the pros and cons of going to trial. But
is
he was not.
Your position that not giving a bottom line recommendation can never be ineffective assistance?
Your Honor, as as stated in Strickland and its progeny, representation is an art, and certainly it depends on the circumstances of the case, the client, and the attorney. So I would not suggest that never. However, I do not think that requiring such a bottom line would be an appropriate solution to the few situations that that may occur in.
Let's assume that the court is not inclined at this point to make any hard and fast rule about giving a client advice about accepting a plea. And let's just look at this case, where, as opposed to a, quote, very generous plea, the defendant was looking at very significant mandatory jail time. I think, in essence, what defense counsel is arguing here is that anyone who was given those two admittedly unpleasant alternatives, no one is going to take the chance of 35 years in prison, and that's why it's problematic that defense counsel didn't emphasize the enormity of the risk that this defendant was taking.
Your Honor, he did emphasize the risk. He did repeatedly tell him the mandatory years and what he was facing and what he risked. And he actually couched his advice as, you know, 50%, 60% winnable. He didn't overstate this at all. The problem is, this is a person who fully believed in his innocence. And his attorney, as someone who was supposed to be his advisor, his counsel, his supporter, likely did as well, but still laid all the options on the table for him, simply because he has offered what is, in hindsight after conviction, a very good plea offer. His belief in his innocence is what prevented him from taking that plea. And to suggest that a lawyer should somehow counsel harsher or be more aggressive about getting a person who believes they're innocent to take a plea offer simply to avoid the great consequence at the end is not appropriate.
Well, I suppose the response to that argument would be that Mr. Oberle needed to do was to say, look, I respect your, you know, firm belief that you're in your innocence, but I'm, you know, just telling you what the realities are of the process, and given those realities, I would urge you to take the plea, or I would strongly suggest you take the plea.
And he did all but those last words that Your Honor used, absolutely. And that is the issue, because at that point, is that not inherently coercive for this attorney with 35 years experience, who has been on both sides of the table, who has done this for a long time? When he looks at that client and says, I urge you to do this, I urge you to do this, we would be here on another matter.
So the defense counsel is always between the devil and the deep blue sea. If you don't recommend something strongly enough, you'll have Mr. Maurer complaining, and if it's too strong, then Mr. Maurer would be complaining.
That's correct, and that's exactly why Strickland and its progeny frowns on bright line rules, because these things don't fit neatly into any bright line rules. It depends on the client. It depends.
Did Mr. Oberle use any adjectives such as "this is a good plea offer" or anything that would implicitly convey that you should take this?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In his conversations with Mr. Burns, in addition to saying that the case was difficult, he also said that this is an extremely generous plea offer and you should consider it. So there is, it's really a parsing of were his words strong enough, and to go back after a conviction, it has been made, because if the same circumstances were presented to Mr. Burns, based on his belief that he did not commit these crimes and his feeling that he would not plead guilty to any sex offense, any words that Mr. Oberle would have used would not have changed the result here.
Well, Ms.
Go ahead.
Ms. Manning, what you just told us seems to be at odds with what you told me a few minutes ago. You know, I asked you, did he make a bottom line recommendation, but not loudly enough, or did he make no recommendation at all? And the answer is we should assume as fact, or, you know, in this case, that there was no bottom line recommendation. But now in response to Justice Ridgely's question, you know, you seem to be saying that he did make a recommendation, even though he didn't do it with the high, with the volume turned up high. So which is it?
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm confusing the terms that we're using here. He did not explicitly say to his client, take this plea. You should take this plea. That is it. He used other words to emphasize that this was a good plea offer that should be considered. So he did not ultimately opine that he should take the plea offer, but he did say that it was a good plea offer to be considered. I'm not intending to split hairs. I just don't want to misrepresent what is actually the record.
Is it fair to say that part of the state's position here relies on the fact that there is no challenge to trial counsel's level of knowledge and investigation into the case, so that when these discussions were going on, trial counsel had a firm basis on which to evaluate what his client's chances were?
I'm not sure I completely understand your question, Your Honor. I apologize.
Well, if we're talking about whether there was ineffective assistance of counsel with respect to a plea, accepting a plea or not, wouldn't you agree that a factor in that would have to be the extent to which trial counsel knew everything about the case and had investigated and was therefore in a knowledgeable position with respect to evaluating what the defendant's chances were?
Absolutely, and this court addressed that in the McDonald case. That's absolutely a factor, and in this case, there is no issue in that regard. Mr. Oberle extensively prepared this case with his client. He reviewed all of the statements that were provided. He even had transcripts prepared and had his client review them, and they together pulled out inconsistencies. This was a top-notch preparation of a case for trial, and there has been no issues raised in that regard, Your Honor. As stated when I began the argument, the defendant must prove that he would have accepted this plea offer, and it is clear based on this record that he would not have, and therefore he cannot meet either prong to establish his first claim in this matter.
And it's clear on this record simply because of Mr. Oberle's affidavit that is not refuted.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the affidavit includes letters and notes to his file that were done contemporaneously at the time. It would be very difficult, even if there were a hearing and Mr. Burns came in and said, yes, I would have taken that plea, that would really be incredible compared to the contemporaneous documentation that's part of this record. As to the remaining arguments that are in the brief, they can be disposed of by this court's opinion on direct appeal. I quote, the strongest evidence that the jury was not prejudiced was its final verdict. The jury convicted Burns on only some of the charges against him. Had the jury been prejudiced against Burns, they would likely not have acquitted him of charges related to Tina Ames, end quote. The state does not concede deficiency on any of the other arguments, and if the court wishes me to address any of those things, I am happy to do so, but otherwise I will rely on the arguments in the state's answering brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I guess I have 340.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. I think that, all right, respectfully, Ms. Manning's last argument might be just the point that I've been trying to make here. And this was a top-notch preparation case, and Mr. Oberle did an excellent job trying the case in some respects. In others, we have quarreled with him, as noted. But in terms of his preparation, that is the whole point we would suggest. This client trusted him. And as I was trying to argue in my opening remarks, that given, I won't necessarily use the word fiduciary, but given the position of an attorney and a client and the trust issue, Mr. Oberle's advice is something that the client is paying for, which under our Bar Association rules, under, in the Berea case, Anthony Amsterdam, a wonderful commentator on criminal defense, says that we as defense attorneys have to give advice, and especially in a case like this. Now, just to finish real quickly on a couple points, when the case was at the, we asked at each level for an evidentiary hearing. Superior Court procedure is that when a motion for post-conviction relief is filed, the trial attorney is asked to submit an affidavit about what they did or didn't do. And that's pretty much the record. I mean, I suppose I could try to submit an affidavit for my client, but we felt that we had essentially asked the court for that when we asked the court for an evidentiary hearing, which the court would not give us. And that decision was made by the commissioner and then affirmed by Judge Slice at the time. So in terms of our burden of proof, which was first established in Lafler, we didn't have a hearing.
When you say evidentiary hearing, you're talking about a live evidentiary
hearing. A hearing where Mr. Oberle could testify and Mr. Burns could testify.
But that didn't preclude your client from submitting an affidavit.
I suppose maybe not. I mean, it's not common practice, but we file our application.
Common practice to get an affidavit from the lawyer, but to get nothing from the client?
In the Rule 61 petitions, yes, the attorney is always required to file an affidavit saying why he did what he or she did.
But this is different than a Rule 61 motion that's based upon comments made at trial or witnesses who were or weren't called, where defense counsel submits an affidavit and says, yeah, I thought about that, and here's why this witness was not a good one, and so forth. This was all about what happened between defense counsel and his client. And under the circumstances where defense counsel is saying, my client did not want to take a plea and told me that repeatedly, wouldn't it make sense if you wanted to refute that you would submit something?
Well, I suppose one could say that. I mean, I thought the filing of the motion itself sort of refutes that.
Well, at that point in time, Lafler had not been decided.
Correct.
Right? So
we didn't know what our burden of proof was at that point.
Okay. So are you suggesting that we should remand this in fairness so that the new rule in Lafler at least can be argued at the trial level?
I would love to have an opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing in this case, and the only way we can have one is on remand. So, yes, that would be part of our – if the court doesn't decide it on what they have, then I would be more than happy to ask the court for a remand.
What we have says that your client would not have accepted any plea to a felony. And that's what we have.
Based on Mr. Oberle's affidavit. I think you can infer from our motion that that's not the case, but we haven't had an opportunity to have Mr. Burns testify about that. So, yes, we would ask for that.
Thank you.
Your time is up. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement and recess. Oh, adjourn.